Welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch. It's Suzanne Muchen sitting in for Steve Bertrand, who's traveling again somewhere fabulous. Iceland? Is that right? Yeah, he's in Iceland. So I have the pleasure of hosting today, which means that I can bring in some of my friends into the studio. So with me today for two segments, so we're going to have a great conversation, is a man you may know, might have heard of him recently, J.B. Pritzker. And we're just going to talk. I'm so glad you're here.
Thanks for having me, Suzanne.
And no tie, by the way.
No tie. It's one of the highlights of my day.
When you get sleeves rolled up, it's awesome. So we've known each other a long time. We were both children 10 years ago, 12 years ago.
Well, you were.
We were young and foolish. So we have been in small offices, 1871, large ballrooms, your office. Never have you been in my radio studio.
Never in a studio with you. I'm so glad to do it.
Well, I'm glad you're here. So here's what I notice about you. When you walk into a room, I feel like the bubble over your head is, how do I make people here feel comfortable? Because I think people tend, for whatever set of reasons, to get a little anxious. And it seems like you feel like it's your job. But today, that's my job. So you're good, right?
I'll take a couple deep breaths.
Okay,
sure.
You can just calm and
I always
and center
feel good
yourself.
When I'm around you.
But is that true? Like, do you feel like you have to do an extra little bit of work just to get the room calm?
I think in my everyday life, over decades, I'm not sure if I feel exactly a responsibility. It's my natural reaction to a group of people is, look, I want to be comfortable and I want other people to be comfortable.
Right.
And I think, you know, generally people are. But when they're not, you know, I look for ways to make them feel comfortable. And I enjoy spending time with people listening and talking and, you know, and sometimes even solving problems with them. I guess that's part of my personality.
Yeah. And you're funny. I think you're funny. So let's talk about something that actually, I don't know, we've had this conversation. We've talked a lot over the years about early childhood, about the tech community, job creation, but I know that you're also really involved with the Illinois Holocaust Museum, which, if you haven't been there, seems like a must-do activity for everyone in Illinois. So how did you get involved with that? Why did you get involved? Because I assume that you get tapped for a whole lot of things.
I was approached by a friend of mine it was about 1999, who said, would you mind meeting with some Holocaust survivors to talk to them about their small museum that was in a storefront in Skokie on Main Street?
Right.
And, you know, and I'm busy and I meet with a lot of people. And so it's always hard to find time for every group. But, you know, a friend called me and asked me. And so I said, sure, I'd love to. And of course, I'd be honored to meet survivors.
Yeah.
And so they came to my office and sat down, and there were two of them, a lovely, lovely woman named Lisa Derman, who has subsequently passed away, who's a Holocaust survivor. She and her husband survivors, and a man named Sam Harris. And Sam kind of led the conversation, and he began by taking his watch off and putting it on the table. And he said to me, I just need 3 minutes of your time. And I didn't realize at the time that he had been in the insurance business before. And that was sort of why he used a gimmick of his watch off and saying, you know,
like
he needs 3 minutes. What I also didn't know is that although he said, I only need 3 minutes of your time, 9 years later, we had worked together to build a Holocaust museum.
Wow.
Yeah. So they had, and they had the idea that, look, they had built this very small museum on the storefront museum, and they were serving, you know, a few thousand kids a year who were coming with their field trips. But there were thousands and thousands and thousands of more requests that they couldn't fill because they just had too small a location. And remember, the survivors had gotten a law passed in Illinois that requires that every student in public school get education about the Holocaust. And they were the first state, Illinois was the first state in the United States to pass a law like that. Now there are something like 27 states that have a law like that. But these survivors were the ones who got that passed. So all they wanted to do was just serve the kids.
Right.
And so they sat down and said, would you help us build a museum? And like I said, 9 years later, we did.
And when people ask you, so why is this so important today? Why does this matter today with so much else going on in the world? What is the Illinois Holocaust Museum? What do you say in response to that?
You know, a lot of people say, well, Holocaust Museum, that's something that happened 75 years ago. Why should, you know, we teach kids about one thing that happened 75 years ago? And of course, it's not about just the, you know, the situation of the Holocaust and the horrors of the Holocaust so many years ago, but rather the universal lessons of the Holocaust. That's really what's important. And that's what those survivors wanted to teach.
Right.
They really wanted kids today to understand that they need to stand up against bigotry and hatred and intolerance. Because if people had done that back then, there wouldn't have been a Holocaust. But there were so many people who were bystanders who said, well, I'm not involved in it. I don't need to do anything about it. It's happening to somebody else by somebody else. I'll just let it happen and keep going along with my life.
Right.
But of course, that's not something we want our kids to think today. And so we say they kids should be upstanders, not bystanders against hate.
Great. I love it. We're going to keep talking. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, I want to talk to you about what it's like out on the road. I have to assume that you're now on the road quite a bit, seeing things that maybe you wouldn't have otherwise seen a year ago, and what that's like. Welcome back to the Wintrust Business Lunch. It's Suzanne Muschen sitting in for Steve Bertrand, who is out on the road and will be back next week. I'm here talking to J.B. Pritzker, who is a candidate for the Illinois governor's race. I've been talking to J.B. just because we've got a lot to talk about, and I think I failed to mention this. One small fact about your life right now, that you happen to be running for governor. True?
I am, yes.
Okay, so I apologize for not mentioning that. So yeah, J.B.'s out on the road, and what I'm curious about is, you must be going to communities far outside the, you know, city limits and talking to people that in the general course of your life as a venture capitalist and tech entrepreneur and all of that, that you don't typically talk to. So I'm curious, what are you hearing out there and how different is that? Is it different than the conversation you're hearing here in the city about our state?
Well, let's start with the commonalities. Unfortunately, so many people across the state are suffering. They're suffering because we don't have a budget in the state.
Yeah.
Education is declining because of that and because of some historical challenges in the state with state funding of education. Hearing, of course, a lot about the safety net in the state falling apart. Shelters have closed. Mental health facilities have closed. So many people have left the service of the public because those budgets have gone away and therefore they're not getting paid. We have a healthcare crisis across the state, and it's being made worse, of course, by what's going on in Washington, D.C. with Donald Trump.
And you're hearing this, you're saying, wherever you go.
Wherever you go across the state. So whether it's here in Cook County and in the city of Chicago, or you're in Carbondale or Peoria or Cairo or, you know, Rock Falls. So we've got a real challenge in this state that we've got to meet and beat. And that the first one is we've got to get a constitutionally mandated balanced budget passed.
Yeah.
It's been 705 days, I think, now.
Not that you're counting.
Not that I'm counting, but I am. number of days without a budget, and it's unfortunately because this governor has refused to step up and actually negotiate one.
Yeah.
So you hear that across the state. I think if you had to highlight some differences, of course, you know, here we're talking about the 96 counties, you know, outside of Cook County and the collar counties, you know, the counties that people in Cook County often don't talk much about, but are so important to the vitality of the state. Like I said, Peoria County or you know, Rock Island.
Right.
So many people are in those areas of the state, you know, they're dealing with agriculture challenges. We've got a coal industry that's declining and manufacturing that's left those areas of the state. Many of those areas have state universities that are the big employers. And of course, they're challenged because there's no state budget.
Right.
Kids are not going to those schools because they don't know if they're going to get their grant money.
Yeah.
And they're choosing instead to go out of state. Now, remember, these are our best resources in the state, these kids. And we want them to stay stay close to home because we're parents, yeah, and we want them near home. And then we want them to stay close to home because for the future of the state of Illinois, if you want yeah. jobs and you want, you know, quality talent, these are the kids who are going to make it happen.
So they're coming up to you with their real life stories, their day-to-day concerns.
They are. And, you know, unfortunately, so many people have for, you know, the last couple of years felt that government just isn't working for them, that nobody's standing up for them. We need to create jobs in the state. Last year, we had 0.5% job growth in the state of Illinois, 0.5%. Yeah. It's a third of the average state in the United States. And yeah. we're the fifth largest economy in the United States. Yeah. So we have to change that. And, you know, as you know, I've been involved for a number of years in creating jobs here in Cook County and outside of Cook County in my own businesses, as well as in 1871, which is a technology incubator, a small business, a nonprofit technology incubator. And those are things I think I can do across the state, create tens of thousands, in fact, hundreds of thousands of jobs for us. And if you ask people who live, you know, south of I-80, what's the number one issue that you're facing? I think you'd really hear jobs,
yep.
and then you'd hear education and healthcare. I mean, they're right up there at the top, really all three of those things. Yep. But I'm the job creator. I think I can do that for our state.
I think you can do that, too. I'm listening to the passion as you're talking that's coming from what you're hearing. And the question I have all the time since you've announced that you were running is, this is an incredibly challenging moment for anyone to be governor of this state. Why? Why raise your hand? And I'm in awe that you did of anyone, by the way, who comes off the sidelines and raises their hand. Bridget Gaynor, a good friend, has a movement called Off the Sidelines to get more women to step up and run for office. Why raise your hand for what some people might consider one of the toughest jobs in the state, if not in America?
You're not unusual in asking that question. Often the question is phrased something like, why on earth,
why on earth
would you want
right,
to
raise
take
your
on
hand.
This job? And it's because everything that we care about is under siege by Bruce Rauner and Donald Trump in Washington, too. The things that I've worked on for so many years, you know, creating jobs at 1871 or in my own business, 55,000 kids getting school breakfast across the state of Illinois in low-income districts that I worked on, more than 50,000 kids and 60,000 adults and thousands of teachers going to the Illinois Holocaust Museum and learning to fight bigotry and hatred and intolerance and take those lessons around. All those things, including and in addition, you know, the Center on Wrongful Convictions and other things that I've worked hard on, every single one of those things is under attack. And so when I think about what my obligations are, it's to step up and try to fix these problems. All of us really, in some way or another, need to step up and help fix this problem. This is something I can do and I will do. And, you know, I've got to win a primary and win a general election. It's sometimes not fun in the process, but it's only because there are others who are competing and they think the only thing they can do is attack. My view is I knew what I was getting into
yeah.
here. I knew they'd throw the kitchen sink at me, you know, and everything else. And yet, you know, I'm a positive person. I really believe that we can overcome the challenges yeah. in the state. And I've worked hard to do that doing public service throughout my life. And this is just another way in which I can do it.
JB, it's really for me. Not just a pleasure because you're great to talk to, but I hear it. I hear the passion, and I also am in true just awe of your willingness to bring everything you've got to the table right now. And I also hope people listening, and women in particular, are thinking about what they can do, because I think there's a moment right now where a lot of us feel a little bit helpless, and there's a lot we can do. You know, maybe not running for governor, but there's a lot we can do to be engaged every day, to pay attention, to read the news, to get educated, to attend meetings, and just be part of it right now. So for that, thank you. I'm so glad that you were here.
Thank you.
No tie, relaxed, being you. So thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome back to the Wintrust Business Lunch. It's Suzanne Musion sitting in for Steve Bertrand. And I have one of my favorite guests. I can say that, I think. It's sort of like your kids. Did, you know, can they say who do you like best? And then you kind of lie to them. Sometimes that's true with guests, but Adam really is one of my favorite guests.
One of?
Among
okay.
top three.
Okay. I'll
I feel like
I'll
top
go
three is
I'll
pretty
go
good okay. for you. So he's a CEO of Stratix. A great company, actually. He leads Stratix sales and partnership efforts, works closely to craft and execute the company's strategic initiatives, but he's also just really knowledgeable about all things work-related, HR-related. So he always comes in with some interesting topics. And today we're going to talk about something that seems to have become the norm everywhere, which are these summer hours.
Summer hours.
Talk to me about that. Is it a good idea?
I think it's a good idea if it makes sense for a company.
Uh-huh. How would you know?
Well, I mean, if you're in a restaurant business, I would say summer hours.
Right, probably not
make
so
sense.
Much, right.
You know, my daughter who leaves for camp this Sunday said the other day, Daddy, what are you going to do this summer? You're going to...
Right.
I'm going to work. What do you uh-huh. mean what I'm going to do? So I think that's the mindset is, you know, we have 3 months of summer if we're lucky in Chicago. And I think we are kind of cursing our weather here today, Suzanne, because... We're talking about summer hours, and it's like 60 degrees.
Which dropped in like a second this
yes,
morning.
The minute we decided to discuss the topic.
Right. So summer hours typically are what? Friday afternoon? People leave early? What's the typical
it's
structure?
It's like everything else in life. It starts with Friday afternoons, and then it's like, you know, casual Fridays turn to casual Thursdays. Every day's casual. Now we're casual. Now we're summer hours and Friday afternoon. Now it's, you know, maybe I'll leave a couple hours before lunch. Can I get Friday off so I can extend my weekend into, you know, Thursday night? So I think it really depends on a company. If you have like a customer service or, you know, big customer service staff, you can tweak your teams so that maybe every other Friday I get off. If I'm in sales, you hit your numbers, you know, that's an incentive to get off. If you're in an account management position, maybe working from home, maybe working from the beach. But, I mean, there's certain positions you have that you
right.
have to actually show up.
Right. And it does seem that it's not an expectation, but a lot of the places around seem to at least be offering summer hours. I know a lot of when at our company, people kind of expect them.
Yes.
So is that a trend that you think is going to ultimately go away? Or do you feel like summer hours are now here to stay?
Well, here's what ends up happening is, you know, all these like fringe benefits. As you know, you start to compete on the benefit front, all of a sudden they become the norm. And then once they become the norm, they become blasé.
Yeah.
So I think we might be approaching the blasé front where, there was a recent study with HR managers that company offering summer hours are down from the mid-60s down to the 20%
ooh,
this year.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
I think it's almost become like, just okay. What else you got for me other than I get off
right.
on Fridays?
So related to this, what is your take on the trend that I've seen out there about sort of unlimited PTO, personal time off, as a benefit some companies are offering?
Well, I think that's a curse for starters because as entitled as some people are in the workforce, there is also the, you know, give me a guideline of how much time I'm supposed to take off, because if you give me unlimited, that might be code for if you really want to get ahead in this company, you don't take PTO.
Yeah, right.
So if you, all the studies show that people don't end up taking PTO, and then we partner with a really good local labor law firm that will tell us that actually in Illinois, you're kind of, you know, might be infringing on some labor laws in terms of paying out that PTO when someone leaves.
Yeah.
If it's unlimited, how much time am I supposed to pay them? And then they go to the guidelines of how much time were I supposed to get if it wasn't unlimited.
Okay. So that's, first of all, it's always good to know the law.
Right.
Okay. So now when you're here, you know that I like to do a little role play.
Always.
Okay. You're the employer. Okay. I'm 24 and it's summer and you've given personal time off. We start at 2 and on Fridays and I'm coming to your office for a conversation, okay?
Sure.
So, hey, Adam, I just feel like a lot of the people here in the office feel like just leaving at noon after lunch would make a lot more sense. Because once people get back from lunch, there's really not so much time anyway. Can we just do this at noon?
Are a lot of people are feeling this way, Suzanne, or you're feeling this way?
Well, me and a couple people in the cubicles next to me all agree. Like, we can just go out to lunch and then it's 2 o'clock.
That's true. And then what happens when customers start to call around 3 or 4 in the afternoon? Are you and all your colleagues going to just somehow via ESP answer those phone calls and those.
Well, but I just feel like people would understand it's nice outside.
I would hope they'd understand, but we need to have a couple people here because, you know, in order to take summer hours, we actually have to stay in business.
Yeah, I know. I just feel like it would be really motivating for all of us to, like, get the time off.
I'd love to take that time off, too, but I don't want to take permanent time off. And if no one's here to answer the phones on Friday afternoon, I think we'll all be looking for a job, including myself.
Okay,
so we need a couple of people here to answer the phones. How about every other Friday, you take off at noon and your colleagues stay, and then you guys can work out a plan, come back to me with a plan where you guys rotate Fridays.
Oh, I like that solution, Adam. That was good.
Yeah.
All right. Well done. I will tell you that there's been a couple of issues in real time over at an organization that I'm a part of, which is service oriented. And they do want to give summer hours as a perk, but the people who are, you know, the customers are like, well, I'm sorry, we need the front desk manned.
Yes.
We do need somebody to receive FedEx. We do need, like, so they've done a system, just like you said, of both rotating staff, so everyone ultimately does get some time off, or you can always hire a temp or two to cover if it really means that much, or is that not a good idea?
Depending what the temp's doing, right? So if the temp's just getting FedEx and tasks like that where you're not customer focused, to me, I would want on the front line my best people to engage with customers. If it's FedEx or delivery or things like that, throw a temp at it. But I'm hiring you based on your personality, not based on your ability to get packages.
And do you think, so based on this role play, is it up to the employee to come to you with a proposal? Or do you think as the employer, you set the guidelines for summer hours and stick to it?
I think it's both. I mean, so I think as the employer, your responsibility is to come up with a game plan, but then also not be so steadfast and hard true to that game plan. If someone comes up to you with a good proposal, be amenable to it.
All right, can I come work for you?
Absolutely.
Would you? I don't know that you would hire me.
I'd hire you.
You would?
You know, you're one of my favorite people, too.
Top three?
We'll go top five.
Okay, that hurts.
I have four kids.
I get it. I still feel like that hurts. And a wife who's lovely, by the way. Adam Ochstein, thank you so much. CEO of Stratix, always great to have you on. Welcome back to the Wintrust Business Lunch. It's Suzanne Muschen sitting in for Steve Bertrand, who is traveling this week. And we have Randy Schaefer, the digital news editor at the Chicago Tribune, with us with some stories that a little bit flipped me out this morning. So I wanted to start with the one about the icons that we've been seeing on Twitter, the emojis that have been showing up more frequently next to people's names, and they actually have deep meanings.
They do, yeah. So, you know, when Christmas comes around and you're feeling festive and you're like, hey, I'm going to put a snowflake in my Twitter name just because I can, maybe think twice about that because it might have a hidden meaning.
Right. So this I didn't know. So tell us some of the meanings. I know there's the rose.
Right. The rose stands for, help me out on this one.
I think this was for if you were sort
Democratic
of.
Democratic socialist.
Exactly. If you were a Democratic socialist. There's the snowflake you just talked
about.
Right,
which has kind of been, I know conservatives use it as a rallying cry against liberals, use special snowflakes, and they've kind of flipped it around and they're saying, well, their strength in numbers will cause an avalanche, so I'm proud to identify as a snowflake.
Right.
But there's tons more. There's Lady Liberty if you're pro-immigration. There's a Syrian flag if you're pro-Syria. A globe if you're a globalist. Or the most interesting thing I thought was the glass of milk if you're a alt-right white nationalist. I have yet to see that one on my Twitter feed, so I guess I'm following some...
I'm going to guess that you're probably not following too many. But it's good to know because I do think that in, you know, the last, let's just call it year or two, emojis have become a whole lot more than just sort of like a cute symbol that people are using. I think people are really trying to use them with a little bit more strategy.
Right. They're definitely getting some deeper meanings to them. So it's something to think twice about before you throw out the peach emoji in a Slack chat with your boss.
Right.
You know?
That one I did know about. Don't use the peach. Let's also talk about what it means if somebody is caught, quote, deep liking. Ooh. That's a bad thing.
This is a huge no-no in the Instagram world. Deep liking is when, you know, you find a cool account on your Instagram Discover page, or maybe, you know, you're looking through an old friend from high school, or God forbid, an ex-boyfriend, and you're kind of scrolling through, and suddenly you're 88 weeks deep, and you accidentally like a photo.
So now why I'm cringing, explain why that's so awkward.
Oh, well, it's awkward because anybody can look and say, hey, so-and-so is definitely scrolling through 88 weeks worth
exactly.
of my life.
Pretty much stalking you.
Right. Basically stalking you. But luckily there are a few actions for recourse, you know.
Like what would you do?
I like to pretend I don't have this problem uh-huh. where I don't stalk
sure.
people. Yeah. Yeah. I'm winking right now. But some things you can do, you can temporarily change your handle. You can set wow. your account to private. You can unlike the photo and then re-like a recent photo so that that person still gets the notification, but they don't see the photo. If you do it quick enough, they don't see which photo was actually deep-liked.
That seems like a lot of work just to avoid a moment of shame.
It does seem like a lot of work just to avoid a moment of shame, but this is America in 2017.
So let's talk a little bit more about shame, because I felt a little bit shamed also with an article that you sent this morning talking about rules to be cool on social media. And in particular, they were talking about things that moms should not do, for example, if you want your kids to think that you're cool on social media. And as I read through the list, there were so many that I had violated before, let's just say 8 a.m.
There are a lot of them.
Yeah.
Kids and teens kind of have their own set of rules for social media, Instagram and Snapchat. So hashtags, they don't use them. They only use them ironically. So they're not trying to use hashtags to get their content out there. They're trying to use it ironically just to make fun of people like me who actually do use hashtags for content
for real
discovery
things.
Purposes.
What about do not post more than once a day? Ever, ever, ever.
Ever, ever, ever. Do not post more than once a day. Not even if you are backpacking through Peru or not even if you're at the
this
top
is on
of the
Instagram,
Eiffel Tower.
Right?
On Instagram, do not post more than once a day. And on Snapchat, even kind of keep it to a minimum. A lot of teens get very irritated when friends will send, you know, 7 different videos from a concert and they're like, just one's fine. We know you're there.
Limit the selfies.
Yes. Space them out at least. So you've got more than just selfie, 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 selfie.
Right. And it also said, do not share a picture from Snapchat onto your Instagram with the filters.
Right. A lot of the kids will use the air quotes pretty filters and then they'll try to crop out the flower crown. You can still tell that you're using that selfie. So it's very uncool for teens to do that.
And do you think teens know these rules? I mean, is this a real thing? And how do teens know?
You know, that's a good question. I don't think it's I'm not a teen. I don't remember back when I had the mind of a teen. That was quite some time ago. But I imagine they were all reading this article.
Right. I just thought that, you know, there are certain rules that if you're a user, you just kind of pick up on, in part because it'll irritate me. I think one of the other rules was just don't take picture after picture of food.
Right. Don't take picture after picture of food. Make sure they're high quality pictures. I think a lot of it is common sense. And I think a lot of it these teens pick up from scrolling through their own feeds and seeing what their peers are doing.
Okay. Well, Randy Schaefer, it's always great to have you on. Randy's the digital news editor at Chicago Tribune. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.